Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Le Poitevin Group conference call. If at any time during this call you need assistance, please press star zero for the operator. I would now like to turn the conference over to David Le Poitevin. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. David here. Welcome to the 2021 Le Poitevin Group call. And, you know, what a year. If you were living in a cave last year and you compared your portfolio at the end of the year, you might have said, well, okay, must have been not much, must have happened, must have been a very boring year comparing my results. Of course, that's not the case. So let me get into it. But first, I want to just thank Le Poitevin Group team members because that was a hell of a year, and we worked really hard. And from my partners in portfolio management from Mark Rinfred and Fletcher Hammonds and Darcy Crowe. I don't think we've ever worked as hard as we did in 2020. Long hours. I know there was a new record set in 2020, which was the amount of talk hours of Dave Le Poitevin. So sometimes I would go home and I would talk so much, oh, do I have COVID? Because my throat, it was just from talking. So anyway, thanks to my partners, and thank you very much to the Le Poitevin Group staff, because everyone came in and we rolled up our sleeves and we protected ourselves by not going out, and we just dedicated ourselves to our clients and what we do, and it's really we all have a passion for what we do, so it's awesome, and thanks very much. Like I said, the market looked a bit like a U last year. There was, of course, the panic. I don't want to dwell on that. We know about that. We sent a letter out in early March talking about the history of pandemics, and five of the six pandemics that we identified since 1900, which were some far worse than what we're in. The market had recovered by the end of the year, and the only one was a small, it recovered to a small loss and then ripped the next year. So the history was pretty strong on what the playbook was, and, you know, that was very important. I'm going to get into the playbook on where we are now in a moment, you know, let me drive on a bit more on some things I need to say. So the history books last year guided us correctly, and you know it's somewhat understandable that given the headlines in the markets that there was a knee-jerk reaction from many investors in the whole world to run to cash, and I guess cash looked pretty appealing. Cash paying zero was better than losing money, But we know, and clients of us have known for many conference calls, that we say money has to ultimately go somewhere. Cash yields had plunged to zero. Long-term bond yields, 10-year bonds, had plunged to less than half of 1%. And so that scenario of that being a good investment had to be only if that pandemic had dragged on for years. One of the things that we said was, despite how bad the economic data is, the stock markets have a way of discounting and looking forward 6 to 9 months. So we had a lot of calls in the fall about the second wave, which in fact has happened. I mean, the second wave is maybe worse than we thought. Look at the reaction in Ontario and New York and California. But if we look 6 to 9 months out, we said you don't want to be in cash on the news of a vaccine. And if we're looking out 6 to 9 months, that puts us in September or October, we should be far more back to normal and there should be less lockdowns. Let's remember we also have summer coming. Summer in BC, we were down to single-digit cases. Really, nobody was worried. They were just going about their business. So when we begin to have some herd immunity and mass vaccinations, we should get a real handle on this pretty soon. So we talk about the markets discounting 6 to 9 months. This is a really important conversation because, as I said, we're looking out 6 to 9 months, and 6 to 9 months gets us sort of back towards a normalist normal and maybe going to a hockey game in the fall or, you know, going out to restaurants, which will approach normality. And is it over then? Is it, that was close back to normal. And what I'm getting a lot of questions on, and thank you for emailing questions in, the number one theme of a question is, what about the debt? And there are two things. It's not just the debt. It is, we sent out a letter, the Lapointeven letter. There's something else going on, which is an explosion of money supply. And the money supply has grown at the fastest pace in any one of my clients' lifetime. And money supply, that's going to have a consequence, and so will the explosion of debt. Listen, when you borrow money, eventually you got to pay the man. You know, it feels good when you get that new, you've taken a loan out, you get all the money, it's sitting in your account, you start spending it, it feels pretty good, but eventually you got to pay the guy. And in this case, an interesting thing happened, which is that in Canada, for example, the deficit being $400 billion, well, we printed $400 billion. So in fact, that debt really was all washed. It was all monetized. We really printed money that we handed out. Now, Milton Friedman talks about the fact that anytime you print money beyond the rate of economic output increase, the result will be inflation. Now, again, when you're in the pandemic, it's a bizarre world. The pandemic itself is a deflationary phenomenon. When people are at home not spending, that's deflation. So the money supply has been massively increased. Yesterday we got U.S. inflation numbers, which show that the year-over-year inflation rate is 1.4%. Ex-energy, it's 1.6. It was decimal 4 for the month. But this is incredible because we didn't have deflation like the 30s. We still have inflation. When we look over the year-over-year numbers come March or April or May, we're going to see inflation is going to be maybe 2.5%, maybe even a 3% number, because right now we're comparing still in a crisis versus no crisis in January of last year or December of last year. So we're looking at year-over-year comparisons, which are keeping inflation looking pretty good. In a survey of Canadian CEOs, the number one concern among CEOs is inflation. So 60% of those respondents said this is the thing that they see that they're worried about. And it's interesting. We talk about a 6 to 9 months looking out. And I said this in my last conference call. The bond market looks like it had peaked in value and yields hit their lowest level, which was U.S. 30 years below 1%. Canadian 30 years at decimal 9%, 10-year bonds at decimal 3 in Canada, decimal 4 in the United States. And interest rates have been steadily upticking. Now, wait a minute. We have lockdowns again. Well, the market, again, looking out 6 to 9 months, is beginning to see this inflation rate. And the implications are, and it's not for our clients because we don't own government bonds at this point, long-term clients, no, I love government bonds. I love to take risk-free, good interest rates. But at this point, it became extremely unappealing. And if you bought bonds because you felt like they were a good hedge for stocks in August, you have lost about 5 to 6% in that, quote, safe haven trade. And this has got very interesting implications because there's these models out there which kind of run 60-40, and you see commercials for things like Questrade, and you can see all the client money that has poured into the Phillips Hager in the north, the Connor Clarks of the world, the Gluskin Sheffs of the world, which have these robo models which are based on history that you should have 40% of your money in the bond market. And If you look just in the first week, the average bond pool is down 1%. And again, since it did extremely well at the beginning of the year, and if you bought a 30-year bond at 1.9% a year ago, hats off to you, because that soared in value 20%. But it's been steadily declining since. We weren't in that trade. I don't regret it because it just made no sense back then. It did go up in value, but it's been dropping, and that implications are that continues to be a very, very poor trade. So I asked people, and some of my clients were asking about, you know, what if we put into these pools? What if we buy Phillips here? What if we buy into these pools that are 40% bonds? Didn't that protect us? I go, well, how's the math going to work? Because if we have a 6% target for our rate of return for the next 5 years, and they're buying bonds at 1%, and their fee is 1, well, that 40% is going to earn 0. And if I'm right and interest rates continue to tick up, then you're going to look at losses of 3 or 4% per year, every year for the next 5 years out of that bond pool. So as 40% of your portfolio is losing 3 or 4% every year, there is very little chance that the 60% would have to earn almost 20% style returns for you to get to your goal, which is highly unlikely. So the implications are that it feels very good right now. Joe Biden's going to make a speech this evening, and he's going to talk about a $2 trillion deficit, because what we've learned is that money is free. We can hand it out. We can borrow as much as we want. But if that worked in history, then we would be envious of South American economies. They have printed, and eventually your printing doesn't work. It doesn't create more wealth. And this is what's coming down the pike. And as investors, we're going to be reactive to this. Now, again, we know that the most important thing that drives stocks on a day-to-day basis, whatever headline, whatever tweet, oh, by the way, I'm looking forward to the next 5 years where tweets don't drive the market up or down 700 points. But the number one driver is money has to go somewhere. So that becomes the number one driver is don't fight the Fed. Now, we were watching Jerome Powell of the U.S. Fed, because the U.S. dictates the world, this morning, and they were talking about the fact that inflation was still below 2, and they were going to allow inflation to go above 2 for a considerable period of time. So it's not inflation that derails the markets. It is the fact that when does the Fed say, whoa, enough? And the reason you must, when inflation gets too big, the poorest countries in the world have the highest inflation rates. I'll quote Milton Friedman again, who talks about inflation. The first inflation is good inflation, because the first thing that happens when you print money doesn't necessarily right away go into food inflation. The first inflation that you see, money, all this printed money has to go somewhere. And again, 25% increase in the money supply. First thing it does is parks it into the stock market. All that new money goes into stocks. So the first inflation is stock inflation. The second inflation is real estate inflation. People, all this new money, it's parked in the banks. The banks say, oh my God, what are we going to do with all this new money in savings accounts? It has to be loaned out. So lending standards get reduced, money gets loaned out, and we get bubble 5.0 in the Canadian housing market, because credit is readily available and interest rates were artificially pushed down. So those are the two inflation rates you start to see. The horrible inflation that we'll see later is food inflation. And you take a working lower middle class, lower class person who might spend 10% of their income or wages on food, all of a sudden that is coming right out of something else, and you get into this spiral. I talk about, you know, when we go travel in these nice beaches and you see these countries with high inflation, they're not as wealthy as we are because the average wage and the average person can't keep up. So this is why the Fed will eventually take the punch bowl away. So I don't have a timeline on when this is going to happen. Because this was a very bizarre recession, we never had a cleansing. It wasn't 2009. It was a government lockdown generated recession. We are not going to see a 10-year economic cycle. We will not see 10 years of Fed printing money and leaving rates at zero. So this bull market could end the end of this year, and it could be several years away. So I don't have the playbook of when we get out. I think at the end of the day, stay tuned, and we will listen to the wording and the verbiage from the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada, and we will react accordingly. I said in my letter, enjoy the melt-up, and that's just really, look, as of November 1st, we're going to election. We don't know who's going to win. We don't know whether Trump would leave if he lost. He didn't. We didn't know who would win the Georgia Senate races, who would control the Senate. So all of those unknowns, and, again, we had these lockdowns and this horrible economy. We had a record amount of money in cash. The melt-up is all the people that ran to cash started piling back in into the markets. Now, when you've created all this money, you're going to create bubbles all over the place. And all this money supply, we have technology shares, which are bubble 2.0. And let's remember, the last bubble of the last time we learned the lesson that you could not pay an infinite amount of money for a great company was 2000. And you know, those great companies like Microsoft and Intel and Cisco and JDS Uniphase and BlackBerry and all those great companies from 2000, we lost 80% because there was a lesson. Now, let's remember, I just was talking to some new clients who were children of some of my older clients who were 35 years old. They didn't have any money in the markets in 2000. So their view is you cannot lose in good technology. I'll give you some interesting statistics that technology, 2% of Americans work in technology, and yet it represents 38% of the value of the U.S. stock market. Oil and gas, on the other hand, everyone knows it's long-term, it's a terrible investment, but it employs 5.6% of the U.S. population, and several months ago it fell to 1% of the value of the U.S. market, even though it employs 3 times more, 38 times more different in value. Now, you know, again, oil stocks have been the best performing sector because nobody wanted it. It was absolutely hated asset class. And they're on fire, and there's probably a long leg to that. People were asking about, you know, the bubbles, and they're asking about Bitcoin. And, you know, it's not our thing. I think, you know, Bitcoin has been a result of you printed money. There's young people. There's people just jumping on a trend that you know, when it fell from 20,000 to 8,000, nobody wanted it, and now that it's going up, people want it. I would urge anyone that wants to buy Bitcoin, and look, if you want to buy it and you think we're in greater fool's theory, if you think, hey, I'm going to buy it because I'm going to sell it, then hats off to you. It's not my game. I think you ought to read book written in 1852 called Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, and I want you to read about the tulip mania. It doesn't make any sense except when you're in it, and all this wealth was saying, hey, we don't trust money. The only thing we trust is tulips. At the peak of a tulip bulb mania, one tulip bulb could be exchanged for one oxen. Now, an oxen was a very, very important part of an agricultural community because it would plow your field, so it had a tremendously high value. One Bitcoin today will buy you a BMW. So one auction, one BMW, I don't know. How much is that BMW? Well, it's one. What kind of currency is worth one unit is a BMW? So listen, we had some questions on that. I personally, in my own account, I would rather own great stocks. We had some questions asking about whether we're in a bubble. And the answer is yes and no. I could point out that, you know, Tesla trades at 10 times the value of General Motors, and it's interesting that General Motors is outperforming Tesla year to date. because Tesla is also an EV maker and it trades at less than one-tenth the value of Tesla. Jim Miller was on the other day, who's a great value investor, and said, I don't know, if I was Tesla, I would buy General Motors, because for 10% of the value, you can buy a company that sells four times more car. And by the way, General Motors is next to Tesla, is absolutely committed to EV. And I mentioned this on my last call, and General Motors is up 25% since we had that call. But I still think at about seven times earnings, eight times 2021 earnings, that it looks very inexpensive. So when you look under the hood, there is a group of stocks that's in 1999 style levels of valuation and absurdity. And then there's General Motors, industrials. I always use Verizon as a dividend yielder, yields 4.5%, no bubble there. Tech Resources trades at $24. In 2007, it was 60. It's a producer of base metals. Base metals are rising, and with all this money printing, will continue to rise. And not only are we printing money, but, you know, Biden's going to talk about stimulus and infrastructure spending. And by the time the infrastructure spending gets going, the pandemic will be over. So there'll be a shortage of all these resources, and then we're going to build a whole bunch more roads to nowhere. And there won't be enough workers, and there won't be enough copper. I mean, it's the most idiotic thing, but it works politically. So where else to go? I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I've mentioned this for several years, and clients will know that were with me in the 90s and in the 2000s, that our biggest holding was in real return bonds, which were yielding 4.25% plus inflation. And even in the early 2000s, the price had gone up and they were yielding 3% above inflation. We sold those for a 50 to 60% capital gain on top of what we paid for them, and we enjoyed an excellent yield. Bell Canada preferred shares have gone up since my last call about 10 or 12%. But they're trading at 14 on a $25 par value. And the reason they got very unpopular, because many of these preferreds were floating rate, and when interest rates went down, the dividends got cut. If we're going to be in a period, and again, this is the hardest part for everyone to decipher. In the bond market is all rates are already going up. Why? The U.S. Fed just said we're going to leave rates at zero this year for the whole year. But the mantra of where it's going in the next several years, again, the stock market looks out 6 to 9 months. The bond market can look out even longer, which is saying inflation's coming back. We are not going to be at a zero interest rate environment forever. Eventually, rates are going up. And so if we're looking at potentially rates going up in 2022, it's not like the preferreds go up the day that rates go up. They're going to anticipate this. So we're already seeing that a preferred share that yields 4 or 5% that's floating is beginning to attract significant amounts of capital. So from a risk-reward perspective, look, Bell Canada eventually will go back to par. It's trading at 14. Are you patient enough? I think it's going to do very well this year. We're looking at double-digit returns from a very low risk-reward perspective. So, you know, industrials, commodities, you'll see shifts in our portfolios with more commodity exposure, not less commodity exposure, shifting away from preferreds that are fixed into floating in anticipation that someday rates are going to go higher, is where we're seeing portfolios. Look, this is a stock market which is in melt-up phase, but it will not be immune to a rolling amount of corrections. It is, you know, people get overly euphoric. Some of our data says that we're not at extremes, but we're certainly no longer this pessimistic stocks climb a wall of worry. So it's always the jab that you didn't see as a heavyweight boxer that is the problem. you know, right now, okay, it feels pretty good. We got the vaccine coming. Markets are hitting new highs. But we're not going to go to cash because there is a correction. There might be, and there might not be. It might just keep going because we still have too much money in cash and not enough money in stocks with nowhere to go. So that kind of is our playbook. I don't have the exit. I'm enjoying where we are. I think we're well positioned for the next 6 to 9 months. I think it's important that we stay in touch. I'm going to read you, I'm looking through my questions. I'm going to read you our former Bank of Canada governor, Stephen Pelosi, likened, this is, I'm quoting here, likened the situation to the aftermath of World War II, saying that few people who grew up in the 50s and 60s recall the straining under crippling levels of debt. Okay? We have in Canada and the Western world expanded debt at the same rate as World War II. Basically, this is, I'm quoting it, basically we grew our way out of it. We never really paid it back per se. What happens is the economy got way bigger, so it didn't matter in terms of the stock of debt anymore. This is the playbook. And what he's talking about, he's not talking about real growth. We didn't grow our way out by growing at 2% a year. Inflation, every financial plan, when I started in private clients and in the 80s, every financial plan we ever wrote had an inflation assumption of 5%. If economy grows at 2, it's actually, when we hear those numbers, that's after inflation. So if inflation is 5, you're growing the total economic output, not the wealth of the people, but the total economic output by 7. We need to accelerate inflation to make sure that this $1 trillion debt, I've quoted this before, Canada had a crippling $18 billion of debt at the end of World War II. How do we pay it off? We didn't. We inflated it away. What's coming? And this is the hardest part. If you're 35 years old and you're going to work for 30 years, no problem. Your wages will go up. If you're 65 and you've stopped working, the challenge will be what you can take to the bank is that real interest rates will stay negative for the next several decades, not quarters or months. Inflation's going higher. Rates will go higher, but they will stay below inflation. And that means if you took your money and put it in GICs at the end of World War II, you lost 60% of your value, even adjusted for the interest rates, over the next 40 years. So the challenge for a 65-year-old is going to be 30 years of life expectancy. How do you account for the fact that the cost of living in your lifetime could go up eightfold or tenfold? So if we think that a senior care is $10,000 a month, it could be $80,000 a month or some number that we can't even conceive of. So that's the playbook. I don't want to leave it on such a dire note, but we need to stay invested. I'm just going to look to see if I had any other questions. Real estate was a question that we get, and why anyone would ask me, I don't know. I've been wrong on the subject for several months, but several years. Look, Canada has a credit bubble. If you're old enough to remember 1981 and 1991, look, at the end of the day, it's an interest rate play. I say rates are going up. 2019 real estate prices, both in Toronto and Vancouver, were weakening, especially in bubble Vancouver. House prices were down 10% in the year we didn't have COVID and we had the lowest level of unemployment. Why were house prices weak? Rates were starting to nudge up. Now we've got Vancouver activity up 53%. So we're in COVID, we're in the crisis, and rates have dropped. Mortgage rates are 1.75 or lower if you negotiate on a 5-year mortgage. Honey, we can afford another $300,000 or $400,000 of debt. Let's sell and upgrade. The game changer will be rates are already going up. What happens at the end of the year when mortgage rates are no longer 1.75? Might be 2, 2.25, 2.5. What happens in 5 years when mortgage rates are, I don't know, double what they are today? So real estate, it's higher until it isn't because rates are still low. Watch those. That's going to be the indicator. Lots of questions about debt, Democrats versus Republicans. Look, Democrats, historically, Republicans have done better under the bond market. The Republicans tend to be the party that is pay down the debt, and the Democrats like to expand debt. Look, Trump wasn't a true Republican. The debt, this is a process that began to change before there was a change in government. From an investment standpoint, let's keep an eye on the big picture, because the U.S. Fed is going to be far more important than if it's Joe Biden or Donald Trump. Again, I look forward to the fact that tweets don't drive 2 or 3% changes in the market, so I welcome that. We'll have to see where taxes go to deal with this debt. Is it all going to be inflation? Are they going to go after the, quote, wealthy? And, of course, in Canada, they consider wealthy above $140,000, which is nice, but it isn't necessarily what I would consider wealthy. But, you know, that's it. Again, that's where we are. Thanks again to my team. Thank you again to the clients, because you guys were tremendously supportive. And, you know, by definition, we had a stock market crash not seen since 1987. By definition, a crash is an overwhelming people that are panicking and are selling. And I know we had a lot of conversations. 99% of the clients listened to that, took our advice, and we got through this crisis, and we're ready for the next crisis, whatever that might be. And the next crisis is probably going to be related to all those questions I got about the debt and about inflation. But for now, they're not fighting inflation, and rates are going to stay low, and there's nowhere else for money to go. So, Mark, anything that you want to add? Mark's in the room with me. I think we covered it. Currency, another question. You know, there's a sort of a overwhelming consensus that the U.S. dollar will decline and it's over and the deficits. And I said, well, over against who? And you know, as I showed in that Lapointeven letter, the debt in Canada expanded far faster than the debt in the United States. So when I say, well, people don't like the U.S. dollar, you know, there's a movement away from cash. I'm not convinced that the U.S. dollar it's over for the U.S. dollar. We like the euro more than the U.S. dollar. Canada is going to react to the fact that it's a commodity currency. I'll give you the cyclical part of Canadian dollar. Canadian dollar does well from December to April. I'll up my target range. I think, okay, the Canadian dollar could be in the low 80s. I don't see par again ever. And I see a problem in the long run of the Canadian dollar, because Canadians have so much more household debt than Americans that they will not be able to withstand the higher rates when and if they do come. So I don't know. I've not said hold cash. Don't hold U.S. cash. Don't hold Canadian cash. So the exchange rate, it is what it is. If we lose 2% on the exchange rate, but we make 12% in the U.S., then we've made 10. So it's how's the bottom line doing? Let's not worry about currency at this point. The only people that should worry is the people that are all in U.S. or all in Canada. Diversifying around the world still makes sense. So that's it, everyone. Talk too long again. I'm like 6 minutes over. So once again, if I haven't answered your questions, drop me a phone call or an email, and we're happy to get to those. So thanks, everyone. Okay, operator, that's it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Lapointeven Group conference call for today. We thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.
Hello.